Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us today as we are winding down 2018, looking ahead to 2019. Lots to do on the program today. We are going to be, in a little bit, talking about the legal troubles that are facing Goldman Sachs, what practices they were using that are now being criticized, and how the bank's CEO is responding. We're also going to be taking a look, as we do around holidays of various types, we're going to be taking a look at what the business numbers are connected to that holiday, at least so far, maybe in years past. But for those of you who are regular Bloomberg readers, there was a really interesting story about, and any active Instagram users, I'm sure, have seen something like this. This idea that of startups that are like, you know, promising kind of this digital nomad life, right? Saying you can work anywhere, do this thing. And certainly, like, the Instagram pitch is quite beautiful, right? And like, lots of active, fit, good-looking young people doing their thing with their laptops all around the world. Well, there is a piece in Bloomberg, and just a bit, we're going to be talking to the reporter who wrote that piece, all about a particular startup, but a bigger trend, really, of what happens when a startup folds, because often it's very suddenly, and it often leaves customers and employees of the startup in a lurch. So we're going to be taking a look at that. So joining us now, Ellen Hewitt, reporter who covers startups at Bloomberg. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So talk us through this in particular. You focus on one startup in particular, and through the lens of a young woman who was on this trip. But let's paint a more, you know, a little bit broader picture of what this landscape is, and just how many startups are folding in a general year, just for some context.
Right. So the statistics depend on who you talk to. There isn't a great way of tracking how many startups are created and how many fold every year, because this can often just be a small project with a few people, and there's not really like a registry or anything like that. But there is a group called the Kauffman Foundation, and they track entrepreneurial activity in the U.S. and worldwide. And their number is something like 6.5 million startups made every year, which I think is quite large, but includes everything you would consider small businesses, not just, you know, Silicon Valley venture capital funded type startups. And depending on who you ask, also, the rate at which these companies fold is dependent on the source as well. But generally, you know, conventional wisdom and some statistics suggest it's somewhere between 50 and 90%. So most companies fail, most startups fail. I think every entrepreneur knows that. But I think what we wanted to explore was, like, behind every story of a startup closing, you know, sometimes it's something small, like, okay, maybe this was an app for playing a game, or like doing some small task. But sometimes it's a company that even if it didn't get big, the relationship it had with its customers was very deep. So in this case, we were writing about a company called WeRoam that served a small number of people, so maybe about 100 or 120 customers, helping them do travel around the world while they worked remotely. So basically, this group would plan trips, and the customers would pay a certain amount of money in order to move every month to a different location. This was like in Bali, and in Croatia, and like Buenos Aires and places like that. And they would set up a place for you to stay and a place for you to work, like a co-working space. And assuming that you had gotten permission from your job to work remotely, this was sort of the life that you could live. And then, we just sort of wanted to put it in context of, like, you know, startups die every day. We often don't hear about it because usually it's small or the company isn't excited to talk about it. But we thought it'd be interesting to follow this story. This was kind of a more dramatic version of this, and then to make a larger point that this is very common.
Right, right. Well, you know, it reminded me of, you know, there's so many companies like this on Instagram. I think, you know, many Instagram users, I'm sure, have seen something like this, and it's hard not to kind of go, well, that sounds kind of good. I could get on board with that. Certainly not a radio host where you have to be in the studio, but I think for a lot of jobs that are more and more portable as time goes by, I think it's hard not to dream of something like that a little bit. And it reminds me of the name is escaping me right now, and it was, I don't know why, because it was all over the news for so long. It was the festival in the Caribbean
Fire Festival.
That's the one, the Fire Festival. Right, that's the one. Right, where all these people were sold this really luxurious time and end up arriving with, like, stay in a tent and have a bologna sandwich. It reminds me, very different deal.
Right, the thought crossed my mind as well. I think, you know, what was most interesting about WeRoam was you know, they, and there are a couple other competitors in the space. Remote Year is a big one. Another one called like Hacker Paradise was popular as well. And they would, you know, they're selling this dream, right? Like imagine if you, you know, everybody wants to travel, but of course it's hard to give up your source of income. And so that this is sort of the, you know, the ideal if you really want to escape and live this other life, because it gives you the ability to explore this lifestyle, this digital nomad lifestyle, which is increasingly popular. And it gives you a bit of training wheels. Like they'll set up the itinerary, they'll book the places, they'll have someone, you know, they'll have travel, sort of, you have built-in travel buddies who are going to be traveling with you, and sometimes that can be hard to find as well. And so I think part of what made some of the customers that I spoke to, you know, turn a bit of a blind eye to things that, you know, stuff that maybe didn't go quite right, or they thought it wasn't as organized as they would hope, they were sort of like, well, you know, it's a startup, and also I really want this to work. So I'm really hoping that this is going to work out. And then for many of them who had started on the trip when the company closed, it was a huge shock, you know, because they were, they had just arrived at their new location for the month, to get an email then in the morning from the CEO saying, like, the company is shutting down. We have a few weeks. You have your location, you know, your lodging for the next month, and your plane ticket to the next place, but there's nothing going to be waiting for you there. You don't have any accommodations or place to work. So they felt like they were really scrambling, and some of them ended up continuing traveling on their own, using some of the stuff that they had learned from the time that they were with WeRoam, but other people ended up, you know, some of them had arrived just that day for their first month on the trip when the company shut down, and that was a huge shock for them as well. And then there was a sort of the third category of people who had paid deposits with this company, preparing to go on a trip, maybe even making major changes to their apartment, their job, maybe the the places where they were planning to live, and then they get an email saying, like, actually, the company's going under, you're not going to have access to this trip, we're trying to get refunds, but those actually never came through. And they also ended up arranging you know, discounts with some other companies, but some people were so burned by the experience, they didn't end up going on the trip at all.
Sure. And I think for most people, if you pack up your life planning to be gone for several months to a year, and suddenly you're told, nope, you got to stay there, and you're not getting a refund, you don't have a lot of options. Like it's not
yeah.
You can just snap your fingers and grab another apartment and, oh, well, no big deal. I mean, that's a pretty big financial blow there. And so was there,
right.
Was there a contract? Was there that kind of thing? That's it?
Mm-hmm.
There's no recourse that can happen.
So this is, I think, one of the more applicable lessons from this experience, which is as a customer, you're really the last person in line to get paid back if something like this happens. And that's so shocking to people because I think they're used to, you know, some sort of consumer protection. They're used to like, okay, well, you know, I paid for this service. You promised that you would take me on this trip. I paid you maybe $4,000 or $5,000, or even in one person's case, $11,500, you know, to get services from this company. Company closes. You're sort of sitting there thinking like, okay, well, they'll definitely pay me back, right? I think many of the people who had been customers of WeRoam learned, and I sort of knew, but I was reminded when I was reporting this story, is that, you know, when a company like WeRoam, it's a small business, they were a startup, they didn't get to the point of raising venture capital funds, but they had raised debt from, you know, like small business loans and places like that, and then also debt that had been personally guaranteed by the two co-founders. In that situation, the people who are going to be most able to get money back are the lenders, so like the banks, the debt providers that this company used. They're first in line. They have contractual rights to money in a way that customers do not usually. And they also have the means to go after trying to get it. They're just so much more prepared to get that money back than otherwise. And the customers ended up banding together. You know, they had all been CC'd on an email together, and they organized themselves to try to figure out, like, how can, you know, can we get this money back? The problem is, like, there's just so many things stacked against them. Very few lawyers want to take on a case where they know that the company that owes the money is insolvent because, you know, this company is shut down. You can assume they don't have a lot of assets left. And it takes a lot of work to sue the people behind the company if the company itself doesn't have any money. I mean, you can start going down this rabbit hole where you realize, like, wow, there really aren't that many protections for me if I'm doing business with a company that, you know, once it shuts down, no longer has any interest in trying to retain me as a customer, and they don't have any assets that I can go after, and I don't have the resources to do it even if I could.
That's right. There's something that you note in the story, and as an aside for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and share this story on Twitter after the program so you can read it for yourself. It's really very interesting. But there was something that you note in the story that really struck me, and that was how many people had made the decision to go on this trip after something that required healing, like after a breakup or a divorce or a big life change that really kind of made you, left them in a vulnerable state and really had them in a moment where they're like, I'm going to step away for a minute. I'm going to regroup. I'm going to do this big, big thing. So it almost seems extra painful there because here are people who are, a lot of them anyway, in a really vulnerable state of transition and things like that. And then to have this happen, it almost feels a bit predatory to kind of prey on someone who's perhaps in a down moment to sell them kind of this idea of this big dream. And I'm sure they didn't go in knowing they would, be closing the company, the founders anyway, but it, I think that adds an extra layer of awfulness to it, really.
It does. And I think the people who are drawn to this are looking for a change. And often a change comes from, you know, feeling like there was something huge that happened in my life. So many of them had breakups, or they were unhappy with their job, or they were just feeling like, I need to get away. It was a very emotional purchase for them. I think it is fair to say for any of them, this is a huge life decision to leave behind. Often like, your friends, the place that you've lived for a long time, your regular job, you know, the comfort of just being in your home country and going into a very scary thing. So people, you know, the woman who was sort of the main character in the story, she had thought about making this decision for 2 years before she finally pulled the trigger, right? She was like thinking about it, not sure, thinking about it, not sure, finally got inspiration and did it. She was on the trip for a few months and then the rug gets pulled out from under her. So, you know, it's not like this is true for every company that shuts down, but I think part of the reason why we thought this was an interesting one to tell was for that reason. And then I think, you know, what that just means then that these customers are left feeling very emotional afterward as well. And many of them have, felt very interested in finding out what the founder, the founders of the company are up to now. It's very complicated. You know, they reach out for answers from the CEO, Nathan Yates, and he gives some answers, but, you know, he's living abroad. He has now started a new company. He's the CEO of a custom-made surfboard company in New York, and I know that rubbed some people the wrong way, who really felt like he should be working harder on getting them their money back. But I think what they've started to learn is, like, it's just, I don't know, I think they just, the world is sort of a harsher place than they might have expected. And I think that was really hard for some of them to hear, and I think anyone can sympathize with that. And in particular, there were also some customers who had paid deposits, you know, just a few days before the company shut down. And to them, that felt really like, wow, I can't believe that they would take my money when they know that the company's closing. You know, what's interesting is the more that I sort of looked into it and read some of the emails that Nathan, the CEO, had written and talked to some people who had knowledge of what was going on, like, it was also became clear that for the people running the company, this was a very sudden thing as well. Like, maybe if they had been more careful with their books, they might have seen earlier that there was trouble. But the way that they tell it, you know, it was in the last week that several things fell through. They redid the numbers more conservatively. They realized, oh, my God, we can't make it through a couple months. Like, we need to make some big decisions in the next 2 days or so and figure out how we need to address this. So it also taught me, and hopefully our readers, just how quickly, you know, fortunes can change with a small company like this.
Mm-hmm. And it really, I think, speaks to a bigger issue or a bigger theme there of, if you are running a company or thinking of running a company that has people's lives, you know, not life and death, but certainly their livelihoods in your hands, I think you do have an obligation to play it perhaps a bit differently than if you're running, say, like a restaurant recommendation app or something like that. That would just be an inconvenience.
Yeah.
I think there is a moral obligation to do things.
I agree.
A bit differently.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Ellen Hewitt, reporter covering startups at Bloomberg. I appreciate you taking time out of a Saturday to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a little break, and we come back more to talk about here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I always appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Lots to do here on the second half of the program. For those of you who listen regularly, you will recognize our next guest. That is Renee Merle, reporter covering Wall Street at the Washington Post and a regular contributor to this program. Renee, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote recently about the legal troubles that face Goldman Sachs, and that has been a really interesting but complex story to follow. So if you would, bring us up to speed with the latest on that.
Of course. So what you have here is that Goldman Sachs helped an investment fund based in Malaysia raise about $6 billion several years ago. The problem was that most of the money, or a good chunk of the money, went missing. It was looted. And now there are investigations in the U.S. By various agencies, and in Malaysia by various agencies, to figure out what happened. And what happened this week is that Malaysia actually filed criminal charges against Goldman Sachs and said that they lied to investors and to others as part of this whole scheme.
And so in those charges in particular, or in light of them, rather, a former senior executive has pleaded guilty to those in the U.S. And, I mean, there's a lot of pieces, and because it stretches through international borders, it seems, I think that's where a lot of the complexity gets in, as we're dealing with two different legal systems.
Definitely. I mean, just the fact that Malaysia has filed criminal charges against Goldman Sachs, that is something that's so unusual in the U.S. And it's really hard to determine what it would mean if they were, for example, found guilty. Would it just mean, obviously, a company itself can't go to jail, but does it mean that, you know, Goldman Sachs wouldn't be able to do business in Malaysia anymore, or that they would be shunned in the rest of Asia? You know, the legal implications are pretty complex in this case.
Right. And so there's also been some criticism of practices used by the organization. So talk with us about those.
The investment fund itself, you know, in Malaysia, there's been a lot of indications of potential corruption, you know, and it looks that one of the things that the former Goldman executive admitted to was that they paid bribes to the fund and to others in Malaysia so that Goldman Sachs would secure this work. So there just seems to be corruption throughout the entire process.
There's also some really kind of like reckless and outrageous details here, though. And for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and share these stories so you can read them for yourselves. But reading about some of this, in particular, this one section of your piece at Washington Post, talking about this controversy and this government-controlled fund to pursue economic development projects in Malaysia. And in there, what's being alleged is talking about stealing billions that were spent on condos, Van Gogh paintings, Monet paintings, jewelry, a $250 million yacht, and even funding for the production of the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. That seems so outrageous, like details like that seem unbelievable.
And it's even more than that. I mean, it was diamonds. It was Birkin bags. It was like just an extensive amount of looting. I mean, if you're going to loot $2 or $3 billion, the money just goes really fast. And so the U.S. government is actually trying to recover some of those assets, including some of the distribution money from The Wolf of Wall Street, which obviously can be very complex. They are also trying to repossess. There was a see-through piano that an actor bought that actually was bought evidently with this money that they're trying to recover.
I mean, that's getting into the Trumpian gold toilet territory, a see-through piano. That's a bit much, if you ask me.
Yeah.
And I feel like, oh, sweet irony, right, that we're talking about the Wolf of Wall Street here in this. I mean, that's a little bit too meta, I think.
It really is. And, you know, I love that movie. And it has so much to do about greed and Wall Street, which is really the connection that Goldman Sachs is just hoping that people will not make.
That's right. But it's hard not to make that. So, okay, so when we shift to look ahead to the future, what's the timeline here? And what are we looking at for next steps, both in the U.S. and in Malaysia?
I mean, this is something that's been going on. This case has been unfolding for several years. And so I would expect it to be continue to unfold, especially overseas. In the U.S., the former Goldman executive is expected to, you know, be sentenced within the next couple of months. I know that Goldman Sachs is hoping to settle its case within the next couple of months as well. They could potentially end up having to pay a fine of $1 or $2 billion.
So in addition to things like see-through pianos and whatnot, what has been most surprising to you, since this is your area of focus, what has been most surprising to you about reporting on this story?
I think that one of the questions that's come up as part of this is this endemic or an example of the culture at Goldman Sachs? Goldman Sachs, you know, has been working really hard over the last 10 years to shed its negative image after the financial crisis. They've done a lot of work in that area. And this is something that's kind of challenging them to, you know, to beat back the image of, you know, greed on Wall Street, as I mentioned before. A lot of people are bringing up that cultural issue. Is this the problem of just a couple of Goldman Sachs executives who did a bad thing? Or is this the way that Goldman Sachs works? And so just having Goldman Sachs having to grapple with that question again has been very interesting.
Certainly. You know, for as much as we talk about financial organizations and practices and even the stock market here on this program, it is fascinating to me how much it always comes back to the human component and human behavior again and again and again. For as much as we talk about don't invest emotionally, don't make emotional decisions with mm-hmm. your money, things like that, but yet that human component is ever present. So there you have it. All right. So again, those of you who follow me on social media, I want to be sure and share this story out so you can read it for yourself, because it is really, really a fascinating one. Renee Merle, thank you so much for being with us again today.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hello there. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Well, certainly one of my last shows before the new year. So lots of holiday stuff going on today. A lot of people out on Michigan Avenue. I think they call it, was it not Panic Saturday, but Scramble Saturday, whatever, that like last big weekend shopping day before, of course, Christmas hits. And then
I thought Bob did say something about
Panic. Yeah, he had a name for it.
But I had never heard that until he said that.
I hadn't either. No, Panic Saturday sounds like kind of punk rock and riot-like.
Some people say, I saw some references to Super Saturday also, but that's not.
I mean,
not...
that's a stretch. Is it super? But everything is so beautiful on Michigan Avenue, right? It's so glittery and pretty. And all that. And there is there's a New York Times story I would like to share the lead of which from. I wanted to read it to you because it is very funny.
Well,
very good.
The headline is good too.
Well, the headline, I feel like I'm giving away. Well, now I got to. Thanks, Griffin.
No. You don't.
No. The headline is, what is glitter? And you look at that and you're like, oh, whatever, Etsy, blah, blah. No, it's really a thoughtful and interesting piece. It's also a very long read. I'm going to tweet this after the program because it's really interesting. But it begins thusly. Each December, surrounded by wonderlands of winter white paper snowflakes, bright red winter berries, and forests of green conifers reclaiming their ancestral territory from inside the nation's living rooms and hotel lobbies, children and adults delight to see the true harbinger of the holidays. Aluminum, metalized, polyethylene. I don't know how to say this word. Let's say, what do you think, Griffin?
Terephthalate. No.
I'm going to say terephthalate.
Terephthalate. Yes, I think that's right.
Clearly, we're not scientists.
Terephthalate.
Terephthalate.
Yes.
Aluminum, metalized, polyethylene, terephthalate. Sure. That's glitter. That's what that is. and it's all about how it, I'm telling you, this is a long story. We printed it. It's like 12 pages long. And it is all about what is glitter? What is it made of? And you think, and immediately I look at the story and I'm like, what? And then a second later, you're like, of course, that's some strange metal chemical compound, but it's on everything. Everyone actually hates it, even if it looks beautiful, because it gets on everything and it doesn't go away. And then you walk around with like glitter in your hair for weeks, no matter how many times you shampoo, all those things. It is fascinating. Why have we not examined this sooner, Griffin?
I wish I knew. I wish I had been the one. You mentioned that no one likes it. There was a sentence in here that I enjoyed that speaks to that, which said, humans, even humans who don't like glitter... like glitter.
I know, that's the thing. It's beautiful and it's
sparkly. We are drawn to shiny things in the same wild way our ancestors were overcome by a compulsion to forage for honey. Like, it is primal, somehow primal.
Okay, that is a stretch to me to make the case that the...
Attracted to shiny things?
Attracted to shiny things, but not like, oh, glitter is a primal urge. I'm not gonna say that.
I'm saying that. You're not, but I am.
I'm not going to say it. That said, in sweet irony, the first thing I saw on Instagram this morning, I opened my app, you know, and it loads to the most recent thing. And I saw a picture of a casket for sale that was an entirely glitter casket. Just for the record, I don't want that when I'm dead. And here we are again talking about my wishes for after I'm dead. I feel like that's our go-to theme, Griffin.
A glitter casket?
Yeah, no, I don't want that.
Huh.
You're thinking about it, aren't you?
Well, it's like kind of useless because no one's going to see it after. It's just for the one day, really.
Well, yeah. But you thought about it. You paused. I saw you look out the window.
Maybe if
and
it makes
like,
you. No, I'm just. I'm open to it for somebody else. I don't need it. But
it doesn't seem like a Griffin move. It's a little more Elton John Liberace than
people
Griffin,
would be but... like, he was holding this back. The,
I know. He wanted thought to be. We knew him.
He wanted to shine. I thought he was not, from the way he dressed and comported himself, I never would have guessed. Yeah, the story is wild. So it's by Katie Weaver, who has written a bunch of great celebrity profiles recently. She did one of The Rock that was fantastic and a couple other good ones for other outlets, in GQ mostly, I think. But then this is in the New York Times. It talks about the history of the word, which because the word glitter predates the noun glitter, right?
Like something is glittering.
Right. Yeah. She says it was used as a verb or something could have glitter, like the glitter of glass. So I guess that's a noun. But still, it's not an actual physical object until the 1930s when a German immigrant invented a machine that could to cut scrap metal into extremely small pieces. And then they didn't start filing patents for machines that could cut foil into what he called slivers until 1961.
I'm telling you, there are so many good lines in this story. And also, it hits every nerdy place I like, right?
Yeah.
It's talking about the factory. It's talking about word dynamics and part of speech. Like, it has this sentence, glitter is a mass noun. Specifically, it is a granular aggregate like rice. And I'm like, ooh, that's like, ooh, that gives me shivers. Like, I love word nerd, things like that. But there's this other great line in there talking about what the writer is wanting to go to a glitter factory to examine this.
Right.
He also did not want me to visit his glitter factory. Like, there's so many good lines in this story. I might just have to take photographs of this printed page that we have and then just tweet them out because it's just so good.
Yeah. And the business angle, I think, is it centers on this company called GlitterX,
which sounds so big business.
Right.
I'm
yeah.
The CEO of GlitterX.
Most of the glitter that adorns America's name brand products is made in one of two places.
It's like a glitter monopoly, Griffin.
The first is in New Jersey. The second, however, is also in New Jersey.
The great New Jersey glitter capital.
The first is a rumored farm site of glitter's invention, right? But it refused to answer any of her questions. And then, we are a very private company, a representative said via email. And the second was GlitterX, which she was made more headway and did eventually end up visiting the factory. But weird, the secret of nature. And you just have to follow the story. I mean, there's no like smoking gun, I don't think. But it is fascinating
that brought down big glitter.
That a company, a glitter company, would be so secretive. I guess if you're a company and you hear that someone from the New York Times has questions,
yeah,
you just shut down immediately.
And
but
also,
why?
If you're not a company that's used to answering questions, you probably
right.
do not have like a comms team there to strategize with you if you get a call from the New York Times. Whereas just on the other side of the break, we were talking about Goldman Sachs, who we're talking about their rampant spending and looting and all these accusations internationally and all this stuff. You're used to, you're a public company. You are used to having to answer some questions. You have a whole team there to advise you legally and, for the PR tactics and strategy and all of that. But if you're just the humble glitter maker, you probably don't have that in your repertoire of things that you're doing regularly. So you probably don't have like, who's the glitter spokesperson? Glitter Spocks? I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And she addresses this question later on in the piece. She said, did GlitterX worry that I would describe its equipment so accurately that readers might construct their own machines to manufacture their own glitter in bulk quantities? Mr. Shetty,
strange times.
Mr. Shetty said that trade secrets aside, confidentiality is a top-down requirement from clients of GlitterX. Companies do not want others in the industry to know what glitters are in their products to prevent competitors from making identical formulations.
And so there's a section of the story in which they're talking about the process by which the aluminum is deposited on both sides of this film. So it's not like a sharp shard. So it's like a, you know, a bendy, flexible, not going to cut you sort of object. And so she's talking about this metallization, which is a, not a word I thought I was going to be saying as much as I criticize things Asians. But so she's talking about that and this exchange that she has with this glitter maker. And, you know, he's kind of giving like kind of short answers. And his son is there and like, well, how is that accomplished? With heat. Well, what are they evaporating out of it? Aluminum. Like, it's just these, like, this is clearly so unnerving to these glitter manufacturers.
I'm thinking
that she's there.
Of all the president's men, you know, those phone calls.
They're so unnerved by this. And then the following sentence in the story is, I have no idea how humans figured out how to do that or why it occurred to them to even try, but it sounds expensive. Again, this story is so, I want to say the story's gold, but that sounds like a glitter pun and it's not. I just want to say this is a fascinating story and I'm going to tweet it out.
It's a fun one. And do you find yourself using a lot of glitter this time of year?
Why would I have glitter?
I don't know.
I don't have.
People
I have
craft at the holidays.
I have zero glitter in my life. I might own one eyeshadow that's kind of sparkly for a good occasion, but I don't. I'm not really a glitter kind of lady.
I probably found myself at an EDM concert a week ago. Truly, at the Aragon Ballroom, a band called Rufus Du Sol.
Yeah, word. Were you wearing body glitter? Or
I was not, but some people were.
Most people were.
No, not most, but some, you know, because it's December. You know, like I think glitter, body glitter is a kind of thing that people do for certain kinds of concerts, like the band that I was at. But I think you need to be outdoors, and because like if you're gonna have your shirt off, it should be outdoors in the summer.
Sure.
So everybody was like.
Glitterish winter glitter.
Yeah,
modification.
Yeah, it was like the clothes were very tight. I'll say, but there were still layers. You know, it was the December version of that kind of thing. But there was some body glitter there.
Sure, as there should be.
It was new to me. I don't go to many EDM shows, but anyway.
Well, I will say as a. observer of glitter here in the workplace, like we're all decorated up for the holidays here at WGN Radio. Tree Time always does a beautiful job for us, and I feel like there's glitter in the facility, like in the studio, for months. Like by Valentine's Day, it'll be gone.
Well, that's the thing;
it sort of hangs around.
It doesn't go away. Yeah,
I'm really fascinated in the seedy underbelly of the glitter world. Now, this is a fascinating thing.
And yeah, I hope there's like a series of follow ups.
If they had just been like, "Yeah, totally, we'll tell you all about glitter," it wouldn't have been a thing. But because they're resisting, now I'm like, "Oh, I will find out."
It wouldn't have been a 12-page story when you print it out, but now it is. Yeah,
it's fascinating. Who thought?
Maybe we'll get somebody from GlitterX on the show.
Let's do it. Let's get the CEO of GlitterX onto this program. Because I have some questions. All right, that's enough of that. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. That does it for me, so it's time to turn things over to our friend Scott Catoon for the Startup Showcase. What's happening on the show today? Now, hang on, wait. You've done something else to your hand. What's going on?
Oh, yeah.
Every time you come in here, you got a sling or a cast.
So I got this little, like, it's like, it's supposed to straighten the finger so
don't
I can start getting
off.
To bend.
It's on there.
I put it on for like 10 minutes at a time. Anyone who's had surgery on their hand, I guess this is how they straighten it out.
It's like weird traction.
Trying to like straighten, which is funny because I bet when I get the bill, this will be like $1,000 for this easily. Stupid little thing. It's like, we talked about this last time, and we should be in like the medical business, like making medical tools. And
I was going to say, I think that this experience with like injuring your hand is going to be like a
It's a new business.
Career changing
yeah.
for you.
Well, it's about that time. I've been at something 3 years. It's time for a new business.
That's right. That's the startup way.
that's my lifestyle.
Did you hear the top of the show? You were probably busy preparing for your show, but talking about WeRoam, the startup, like the digital nomad year
yes.
kind of thing.
How
they went under and like left everybody in a lurch all around the world.
Ironically, I was just reading a thing about the dangers of convertible notes, which, by the way, in our show today, you're going to have Startup Showcase so you can invest your money in companies that can also disappear in the lurch.
No, they won't. They're going to be solid. That's why you have your people vet them.
Well, we do vet them, but like in the end, like this happens to the best of them. Like there's just not enough money to go around and things just happen and it's how it goes. But like what they always say is it's really high risk to invest in this stuff, but the reward is insane. So like, You kind of
if it works, it's going to work.
If it works,
like crazy.
You know that this is not part of your normal like retirement investment strategy. Sure. Like, right? You at least would hope.
You would hope.
But I think people sometimes, you know, wishful thinking.
Yeah,
it's like crypto.
I think the idea, people like get excited and think this could be it's like gambling.
Yes.
Like, this is the bet I feel good about.
Well, there's also,
and that's why people like tank it.
I've had people tell me about this, about the friends and family round, that they're like, it's more than just my own brain. It's like divine intervention. Like somebody up there put this person near me with a great idea. And so I invested in them and it's going to be huge. Cause like, this is my $1 million shot. And you're like, no, that's just a neighbor. Like that's, you need
swing a cat over your head. You're going to find somebody looking for money.
It's
or something.
It's not good, but we try to find good ones.
So who are the companies that will be on today?
So there's the Fluid Project. We only have one today. It's the holidays and it's very hard to find these. The startup people, I feel like I'd like to see more grit. I feel like it was harder to find people on a Saturday than normal. And they're like, oh, we're traveling for holidays. And I was like, you haven't watched Wall Street. Money doesn't sleep, bud.
Like money doesn't sleep.
It does. You know,
it should be on a shirt.
It should
merch.
Be on my
you
shirt.
You need some merch. That's what you.
I do need some. I just tried to sell like a Technori shirt, but I'm not creative enough. We tried to actually. I tried to do one with like the unicorn from Step Brothers.
Yeah.
But it got poo pooed because there's, I guess, trademark things.
I was infringement. Saying, I could see some infringement issues.
I'm just a startup guy. You know, give me a break. But
the old shrug it off. It's fine. I didn't know.
That yeah, good, that's good. My life. Well, it works until you're, you know, at a certain point, then it doesn't work anymore.
Then no. Okay.
But, yeah, we do have a cool show. We've got the Startup Showcase. And then obviously, with the holiday come around, we wanted to throw something fun into it. The podcast, what we do a lot of times is I have an inbox and people send me crazy ideas. I'm going to read some of this year's crazy ideas that got sent to us. Yeah, there's some good ones in there. Some that you will like. So we're going to do that and it should be a good show.
Awesome. How about it?